And Senator McCain, welcome to The Exchange and welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you very much, Laura. It's good to be with you.
I'm a New Hampshire voter. Why should I vote for you?
I think you should examine my credentials and my experience, but most importantly, you should pay attention, as we are going to in this program, and my vision for the future of the country. I hope that my previous legislative and life experiences would qualify me for your consideration. I believe we need to reform government. I think we need to reform the campaign finance system. I think we need a strong national defense and a coherent national security policy.
When you say reform government, that's something a lot of people say. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Well, we need to reform the military. We need to restructure it to meet the post-Cold War challenges, which we are not prepared to do now. We need to reform education to meet the requirements of the information technology revolution that we're going through. We need to reform the tax code, which is now a 44,000-page chamber of horrors for the average citizen.
I didn't realize it was quite that long.
44,000 pages. We need to reform government to be in tune with this information technology that is fast developing with such breathtaking speed and impact. Our institutions of government are geared to oversight the Industrial Revolution. Now the largest part of our economy next year will be e-commerce, and we have to get... I'm chairman of the Commerce Committee. I spend about 90% of my time on telecommunications issues because, one, they're fascinating, but two, their impact on the future of the economy of this country and the future, basically, of how we live.
Senator McCain, the word maverick is almost always attached to your name.
I prefer patriot and great American.
How does it feel to be labeled a maverick?
Well, I prefer other other names, but I think that in some ways it probably fits me because I am very clear in my vision of what my principles and what my vision of America is about, and sometimes that causes me to take on the leaders of my own party or even disagree with my own constituents from time to time. So I think that it's probably been a bit overstated. As you mentioned, I have a 95% conservative rating. I'm proud to be a conservative Republican, and I've never advertised myself as anything else. But I also believe in the tradition of Teddy Roosevelt, I am a reformer as well. And right now, we're badly in need of reform.
Do you think your experience as a prisoner of war in Vietnam shaped the senator that you eventually became?
I think that any experience such as one that I and my friends went through are more defining, but my principles and my ideals and my goals and my values had already been formed before I became a prisoner. I'm sure I'm a better person for the experience because I was able to discover both my strengths and my weaknesses. And I hope that it gave me a better insight and knowledge into human frailties. And frankly, I fell in love with America. I always appreciated America, but I fell in love with America when I was deprived of her company.
For 6 years?
Yes.
You said that hardship, and it was a terrible hardship, being a prisoner of war for 5.5 years, taught you about your strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. What were those strengths and weaknesses that you discovered there?
I think my strengths were that I had the intestinal fortitude to resist an offer of early release by the Vietnamese, for which I am forever grateful, because it was instilled in me the absolute importance of honorable conduct. I think the weaknesses are that I did not hold out as long as I had hoped that I could under intense physical pressure. And I did not measure up to the standards that were set by some of the men who I had the privilege of serving with, who were my personal heroes. The great privilege I've had in my life is to serve in the company of heroes. I was privileged to observe 1,000 acts of courage and compassion and love, and I will always treasure those memories. Some people think it was all a horrible experience. I will treasure the memories of my comrades and their performance and their incredible importance to me in helping me in times when I needed it.
You've been called a hero yourself.
No, the real heroes, Laura, as you know, are the names that are on the Vietnam War Memorial Monument down on the Mall. Those are the heroes of the Vietnam War.
You're known, Senator McCain, for being blunt, for mm-hmm. saying what you think, for sometimes mm-hmm. sticking your foot in your mouth.
On several occasions.
Do you think that facing death as you did makes you more blunt? Because after that, you know, who cares?
Oh, I think it probably causes me to be a little more candid, but I was always guilty of foot and mouth disease all my life, so I can't really attribute it to anything beneficial except maybe not being particularly intelligent from time to time.
You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest today, Arizona Senator John McCain, a Republican presidential candidate. McCain's campaign is focusing heavily on the New Hampshire and California primaries. He's been in the Granite State all week on a bus tour called Straight Talk Express. McCain is probably best known for his work on campaign finance reform and anti-tobacco legislation, and we'll talk about those issues, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. In Concord, 224-8988. What's on your mind that you think should be on the mind of the next president as well? Again, the exchange numbers 1-800-892-6477 in Concord, 224-8989. And Senator McCain, let's talk about campaign finance reform first, because you've been saying on the campaign trail that until we take care of that, all other issues will have to just stand aside. What's wrong with the current system?
Well, I'm not sure that they would have to stand aside, Laura, but we can't have fundamental reform of education, of the military, of so many other aspects of government as long as the special interests rule. This, I mentioned earlier, the tax code is 44,000 pages long. We just passed a tax cut bill which makes it several hundred pages longer because we carved out special benefits for special interests. In 1986, we didn't have soft money in American politics. That was the last time we reduced the size of the tax code and cleaned it up some. Now we make it more complicated. I believe that if you really want to reform education, you've got to get education out of the grip of the teachers' unions. I think if you want to reform the military, you've got to get the military defense procurement out of the grip of the major defense contractors. I believe if you want to reform HMOs, you've got to get the Democrats out of the grip of the trial lawyers and the Republicans out of the grip of the money of the insurance companies. Every time I see legislation passed that is of great significance, I see the inordinate influence of the special interests. So if you really want to reform these institutions, you have to remove or largely eliminate the influence of these huge big money contributors who control the legislative process. And I know because I work there.
Now, someone once said that everybody is a special interest to a mm-hmm. certain point.
Mm-hmm. And everybody should be. And
so how do you define what's a bad special interest influencing the process?
It's not their bad or good influence. Mm-hmm. Perhaps some huge money giver may be a good influence on the process. But when anybody who gives huge amounts of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, then they buy access, which is influence, which then diminishes the ability of average citizens to be heard. In the 1998 election, the secretaries of state did a study a few months ago. The 18 to 26-year-old vote was the lowest in history, the lowest turnout in history. They did focus groups with these young people. They said they wouldn't seek public office. They saw no reason to vote because we didn't reflect their hopes and dreams and aspirations, and they believe that we're corrupt, and they're right. Recently, there was a Pew Research poll that showed that 69% of Americans between 18 and 35 feel disconnected from government. Reason given, special interest. Look, the cynicism is becoming alienation, and participation in voting, much less having young Americans run for public office, is dramatically diminishing.
So how have you financed your own campaigns?
According to the McCain-Feingold provisions, $1,000 limit on contributions. I mean, in the last election, I adhered to the McCain-Feingold bill, and so did he. And I've got to tell you, Senator Feingold, who is a liberal Democrat, who I seldom agree with, when soft money attack ads came into his campaign and the Democrat senatorial campaign committee was run to counter ads, he said, stay out.
We should say soft money, by the way, is money raised by parties that are given to campaigns.
Huge amounts of money. Look, in 1907, thanks to the efforts of Teddy Roosevelt, one of my personal heroes. We outlawed corporate contributions to American political campaigns. In 1947, we outlawed union contributions to American political campaigns. In 1974, we cleaned it up again. When I first ran for the House in 1982, there was no such thing as soft money. And I've seen a change in the way that government works as I've seen the dramatically increased... a fellow named Schwartz, who's ahead of L'Oreal, gave $800,000 or $1 million, depending on who you talk to, the Clinton-Gore campaign. There was then a transfer of technology to China, which increased the accuracy of their missiles. This is serious stuff. This is very serious business. Senator Fred Thompson, who is a supporter of mine, who was traveling with me in New Hampshire, will tell you there is a connection between Chinese money that came into this country in the last election and the lack of pursuit of allegations of breaches of national security. This is serious business. And it is now legal in America for a Chinese army-owned corporation. It has a subsidiary in the United States of America to give unlimited amounts of money to American political campaigns. That's wrong.
So there's a big difference between soft money and what's called PAC money, political action money.
Well, the PAC money at least is restricted to $5,000 and $10,000.
Because you've taken money from PACs.
Sure, but that's, you know, it's $5,000 and $10,000. We're talking about six figures. There's now a new category for the Republican National Committee, and that's the $1 million giver. It's lurched out of control.
Do you think that it will ever change? We hear from callers all the time who say the fox is guarding the hen house. Mm-hmm. This is never going to change.
It will change when I and Russ Feingold and others will make the connection to the American people that every time there's a tax bill that carves out a special deal for a special interest, they pay. Every time there's a pork barrel appropriations on an appropriations bill, they pay. I identified $4.5 billion worth of pork barrel wasteful spending on the last defense appropriations bill. They're paying for it. That's where we have to make the connection. And clearly, we've gone through cycles in American history. I mentioned 1907 and Theodore Roosevelt, and I think we will succeed this time. But incumbents have to be convinced that their incumbency is at risk if we're going to see them support.
Let's go to the phones.
Thanks.
Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the Exchange 800 number, the Concord number, 224-8989. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, and our guest today is Arizona Senator John McCain. He's a Republican presidential candidate. Our first call is from Concord. Hi, Richard. You're up first. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Senator Kane.
Hi, Richard. It's McCain.
McCain, I'm sorry.
That's quite all right, Richard. I'm trying to raise my name ID.
A little nervous.
Thank you, Richard.
I just want to thank you for the service that you've given to the American people over the years, and I hope that you are able to continue as president. I would like to ask a question, though, that 74% of New Hampshire voters support public financing for federal candidates who limit spending and take no private donations. A model similar to what passed last year in Arizona. Would you support this kind of reform, and why or why not?
I strongly prefer the McCain-Feingold bill, which does not have public financing associated with it, because I have a philosophical problem with using tax dollars to support candidates who don't share my philosophy. But it is a lot better than the present system. I just recently announced my support of a ballot initiative in California that's backed by Ron Unz, who is a well-known reformer out there. Not because I thought it was perfect, but right now in California, there are no limits to any campaign contribution. So I would prefer it to nothing, Richard, but I think that I would much prefer the McCain-Feingold version because of my dislike of public financing, which may mean an increase in taxes. But I thank you for your very kind comments.
Richard, it's a good question. Public financing has been a part of some campaign finance reforms.
Right.
Thanks. Yeah,
thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Our next call is from Jackson. Jeffrey's on the air. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Yes, good morning. This is Jeffrey Peters, chairman of We the People, which advocates campaign finance reform. And Senator McCain, I appreciate you having stood up for that issue in the past, and I want to find out, in this coming fall, you perhaps will face the same dilemma as you did last year, where Senator Mitch McConnell filibustered the McCain-Feingold bill to death. And I wonder if you will be willing to stand up and filibuster his pet projects or those of the leadership in order to get a vote on this measure, since last time you had 53 votes for it, but that wasn't counted.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you for your efforts at campaign finance reform, and I hope to have the opportunity of working with you and your organization to make the people of New Hampshire and the people of this country aware of how badly we need reform. What we did in the last a month and a half ago was that Russ Feingold and I threatened to shut down the Senate unless we had a chance to have votes and debate on the bill. The leadership agreed that we would be allowed in October for a week to have amendments and votes on amendments. That's the first time we've had that opportunity. Strangely enough, once that the Republican leadership agreed with it, Senator Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, objected, and so did Tom Daschle, the Democrat leader, alleging that only McCain-Feingold would be sufficient. Obviously, that's not the way the legislative process works. I believe that We by having a week and by debate and amendments, it will pass the House, by the way, I'm very confident, this month of September, that we can obtain some momentum. But it's not going to be easy, as you know. No, I can't filibuster all of his projects, and I can't tie up the Senate forever. It's just something that can't be done and is not done. But what we did do was tie up the Senate so that we would have a week of amending and votes, and I think that that's our chance, a significant chance to make progress.
But if McConnell was willing to filibuster you in the past, isn't this issue important enough to you for you to filibuster him and the Republican leadership if they won't allow a vote on it?
Well, first of all, Jeffrey, it is the Democrats that opposed the unanimous consent agreement when the Republican leadership allowed us to have amendments and votes, even if Senator McConnell wanted to do it or not. So let's be fair here. The second thing is that any political observer will tell you that it is impossible to tie up the Senate forever. It is not possible to do that. But what we did was we threatened to tie up the Senate for an extended period of time so that we could get amendments and votes. If there's any inclination in your mind, you think that I don't care about this issue or care enough about this issue, I think that you don't know my record very well. And I thank you for your comments, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. 800-892-6477 in Concord, 224-8989. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Our guest today, Arizona Senator John McCain, a Republican presidential candidate. Our next caller is from Durham. It's Fred. Hi, Fred, you're up next.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Senator.
Hi, Fred.
Laura. I want to just make a brief statement first. I'm probably stop me if I get too verbose.
Oh, you know I will, Fred.
I'm sure you will. I'm a registered Democrat, and from that stance, I want to tell you that your position on issues is your positions on issues is probably the most, in my opinion, the most straightforward of the candidates from either party, and I would. I don't vote a straight ticket anyhow, and I'm certainly interested in supporting you in this election. But I realize that you do have to get the Republican nomination, and therein you have a problem. So getting to the point, I want to talk about your position on Roe v. On the repeal of Roe versus Wade. And I'm sure you're aware of yesterday's editorial in the Wall Street Journal. In praise of waffling, correct?
Well, I think in general, Fred, you're right. There have been several editorials recently that have accused Senator McCain of waffling on the abortion
correct.
Issue. And I'm glad you raised the question. Senator McCain, could you clarify?
Basically, the Wall Street Journal is the most widely read newspaper in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I think that in this editorial, this was a large editorial, it defended Senator McCain's position on waffling, and I think it made an attempt to be even-handed. And what it advocated was the fact that the zealots on both sides of the issue were causing the problem if they quiet their rhetoric, if the matter if the Roe versus Wade decision was repealed, and letting the states decide what to do, the problem would go away.
Well, Fred, I'm glad you raised the issue, because it's something I wanted to ask, too. So let's hear what Senator McCain has to say.
Thank you, Fred. I believe it was not an editorial. I believe it was a column piece by an academic.
It was written by a member of the editorial staff.
Okay.
I thank you. I have supported, I'm a 17-year record of pro-life voting. I am unashamed and unabashed to be pro-life. My point has been that I think we need an inclusive party. We need to keep the principles of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan, that there is room in our party for those who disagree on a specific issue. I believe that the pro-choice and pro-life people do not like abortion in any way, and we should work together on areas that we can work together for, such as encouraging of adoption, including improving foster care, including economic development, so that we can reduce, as welfare reform has done, is reduce the out-of-wedlock children. And there's many areas that we can work together on. And that seems to have been interpreted as some way of me not being an adherent to what I believe in, and that is the pro-life position. And all I can do is repeat that I have a 17-year record, and I would hope that people would rely to some degree on my voting record. But this is a terribly difficult issue, and one that requires, I think, for us to try to work together on, rather than divide up and it be a litmus issue for membership in the Republican Party.
Fred, thanks for raising the issue.
Thank you, Fred.
So what specifically does that mean that John McCain, president, would or would not do, once he's in office?
John McCain would seek the repeal of Roe v. Wade. John McCain would seek an inclusive dialogue and efforts to do the things that I just stated: adoption, encouragement of adoption, encouragement of foster care, encouragement of programs which help young women through this very difficult situation, and a dialogue so that we can achieve the goal. And that would be a very important issue to me, because it's a terrible aspect of America today.
Repeal of Roe v. Wade, you'd said in the short term or long term, and I think that was where people started to use the word waffling.
Mm-hmm. They can use that word if they choose to. My record is very clear.
We're going to take a break.
Thank you.
And in a moment, we'll take a lot more of your phone calls, and we'll talk about tobacco reform and taxes. Stay right with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Thursday on The Exchange, we catch up with New Hampshire's House Democratic leader, Peter Burling. Join us tomorrow for The Exchange.
Support for The Exchange comes from our contributing listeners and Weller and Michael Architects of Keene, New Hampshire. Architects, planners, and interior designers serving all of New England, online at www.wapm.com. And the 10th Annual Labor Day Weekend Craft Fair at the Bay, September 4th through the 6th along the waterfront at Lake Winnipesaukee, Route 11 Alton, with over 100 artisans and craftsmen. Rain or shine at 755-2166.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, and our guest today is Arizona Senator John McCain, a Republican presidential candidate. McCain's campaign is focusing heavily on New Hampshire and California. He's been in the Granite State all week on a bus tour called Straight Talk Express. McCain's voting record in the Senate puts him on the conservative side of the Republican Party, but he's probably best known for bucking the party line, especially on campaign finance reform and tobacco legislation. 1-800-892-6477. In Concord, 224-8989. Those are The Exchange phone numbers for you to join us today. Senator McCain, by the way, has represented Arizona in Congress since 1982, first in the House and then in the Senate. He's a former Navy fighter pilot who was shot down during the Vietnam War. He was captured and spent more than 5 years there as a prisoner of war. Again, we'd like to hear from you. What would you like to hear from the presidential candidates this primary season? 1-800-892-6477. In Concord, 224-8989. Senator McCain, before we go back to the phones, I have to ask you about tobacco, because that's been another huge issue. Mm-hmm. You said when the Senate killed your bill, you said it had, quote, squandered the opportunity to address a serious national problem, that, of course, being smoking. How would you have addressed this problem?
Well, the problem really is that 3,000 young Americans begin to smoke every day, and 2,000 of them will die early as a result of tobacco-related illness. If adults choose to smoke, that's obviously, I'll be paying their hospital bills, but that's obviously a choice they make. But we're dealing with companies that entice young people to smoke. They lied to Congress. They manipulated the content of cigarettes to make it more addictive to young women. All those are now matters of record. They spent $50 million, the most, according to Kathleen Jamison of the Annenberg School, they spent $50 million as an ad campaign and another $50 million in lobbying in Washington to kill the tobacco bill. According to Kathleen Jamison of the Annenberg School, that's the most that's ever been spent in the history of American politics. And they used my name liberally. In fact, they made me a household word in some cases.
We probably appreciated that.
Maybe a four-letter word. But,
so what would your bill do?
The bill would have basically raised the cost of a pack of cigarettes, and that money would have gone to treat tobacco-related illness, in return for which, and healthcare research and other anti-tobacco advertising campaigns. In return for that, the tobacco companies would have gotten some relief from liability and in ensuing court cases. Well, the bill died in the Senate. There was an agreement between the attorneys generals and the states. And it's of interest to me now that a lot of this money that the states have is being used for causes that have nothing to do with tobacco.
In fact, in most cases.
In fact, in most cases. I find that very disturbing and very distressing because the teenage and tobacco use continues to rise in this country. So I think we should have passed it. It's a testimony to the influence of huge money and special interest money in Washington. I don't want to bother you with the details, but I'm the chairman of the Commerce Committee. There are 20 members, 11 Republicans and 9 Democrats. It passed out of the committee 19-1.
Your tobacco bill.
The tobacco bill. And then there was a delay before it got to the floor. The tobacco companies went to work, and we couldn't pass the legislation.
Well, let me ask you about the state money, because that's been an issue here in New Hampshire and elsewhere. As you said, health groups would like to see it used on anti-tobacco efforts, but the states are saying it's ours. We fought for it. Our various legal guns went out and got that money, and the federal government shouldn't tell us how to use this money.
Well, they have a point in that they made the agreements with the attorneys generals, but I can't help but be disappointed that they're not making greater efforts for healthcare research for treatment of tobacco-related illness, anti-smoking campaigns, which have been proven effective in states like Florida and California, and we will continue to have this problem. And by the way, on the issue of taxes, $50 billion a year of American taxes go to treat tobacco-related illness in the form of Medicare and Medicaid. So those who thought that this was a, quote, tax increase, you're already paying a huge amount in taxes to treat tobacco-related illnesses. And every time one of these young kids starts smoking, 2 out of 3 of them are going to have a tobacco-related illness.
That's but it's a hidden tax.
Fact.
You don't
but
see that.
It's a hidden
that.
Tax.
It's
so
not.
The attack that was made on the legislation, well, it's a big tax increase. It's a, you know, it's an old, they changed the debate with the $50 million in expenditure from an anti-youth smoking issue to a big tax and spend issue. And they did it very successfully, and I have to congratulate them. All the major lobbying organizations in Washington, some of them are with ex-senators as members of them, many of them friends of mine, received huge amounts of money, millions of dollars in lobbying fees from the tobacco companies. It's a very interesting commentary on the way things work in Washington. But I'm not complaining because life isn't fair, and that's what happens
Will
sometimes.
You try again?
Sure. Now that they've made the agreement between the states and the attorneys general, they probably will not surface again.
Right. Let's go back to the phones.
Good.
Again, 800-892-6477 is the Exchange 800 number. Concord is 224-8989. And our next caller is from Westmoreland. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Good morning, Senator McCain.
How are you, Richard?
I'm well, thank you. I make the following suggestion in all earnestness and with integrity.
Thank you.
I wish you would run as a Democrat. think your principal issues are supported by the Democratic Party. I think the Democratic Party could use a voice of moderation.
Well, I thank you. Maybe I could run with Warren Beatty. Richard, I think it's I thank you, but let me point out, I am a strong Republican. I'm lower taxes, less government, less regulation, strong national defense, a robust consistent and coherent foreign policy. I believe that my record and my philosophy clearly put me on strongly on the conservative side of the agenda. You know, it's people always complain about not getting credit for things. I worked for years on national security, foreign policy, national defense issues. Now I'm known for the tobacco bill. You know, life isn't fair, as I said before. But I thank you, Richard. But I do believe this, and I've been up in New Hampshire on other presidential campaigns. I do believe that people in New Hampshire respect those who display independence. That's why we have the slogan on the license plate. And I would hope that one of my ability to succeed here in New Hampshire would because I have displayed independence. I am proud to be a conservative. I am most proud of that. I think that's my fundamental bedrock philosophy. Lower taxes, less government, less regulation, encouragement of this information technology that we're going through. But at the same time, when there are things that are wrong, I think you should stand up against them and stand up for what you know is right.
Well, Richard, you tried.
Thank you, Richard.
Well, I also bring you the greetings from Karen Klipstein.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Richard.
Okay.
All right, Richard, bye-bye.
Bye.
He raised an interesting point. Even though you have a high conservative rating and you said that you're proud to be a strong conservative and Ronald Reagan is one of your heroes, because of these issues, do you think that, issue meaning campaign finance and tobacco, do you think you'll have a harder time attracting those core conservative primary Republican voters?
Well, I hope not, because I think that core Republican voters and independent voters, one thing about voters in New Hampshire, you know, Laura, as well as I do, they examine the candidates. They're going to examine my entire record. And I have a long record voting, not just rhetoric, but voting. And they'll be examining my record and my positions. And I think that I can compete with any of the other candidates on that basis. But also, again, they'll examine the record. But as we discussed earlier in the program, they also want to know your vision for the future of the country. That's really a key element. That's why Ronald Reagan prevailed. And by the way, one of my other heroes is Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt believed that there was a role for government. That's why we have national parks in America today, is because of Theodore Roosevelt. So there is a role. He was a reformer. That's why he was able to get through this prohibition for corporate contributions to American political campaigns, because the robber barons were controlling American politics. So one of the reasons why Teddy Roosevelt is one of my personal heroes is because he was very active, and yet he also was a very strong conservative. I think they're not contradictory.
So you can have an activist government
Absolutely.
And be a conservative.
Absolutely.
Let's take another call, this one from Kingston. Charlie's up from Kingston. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning. Good morning, Senator McCain.
Hi, Charlie.
Senator McCain, respectfully but directly, when I hear you speak of reform and against special interest money, it concerns me. Let me explain.
Sure.
When federal regulators, not that many years ago, were trying to stop the reckless lending and outright fraud that led us to the S&L scandal, costing us whatever it was, $100 to $150 billion, it was widely reported that you used your influence to help Charles Keating in his savings alone. And you were commonly referred to as a member of the Keating Five. How do I reconcile that with your talking about reform and integrity and your 17-year record?
Well, thank you, Charlie, for the question, and thank you for the respect. The fact is that there was a three-year investigation culminating in Ethics Committee hearings. I was judged as, quote, having used poor judgment. Actually, I did worse than that, because the fact that I went to a meeting with four other senators with a group of regulators was wrong, and not because of anything that I said or did, but because of the appearance that it created. I think that people will judge that what I did accurately is wrong. I think they will judge that in the entire context of my service, both in the Congress and to the country.
It's a good question, Charlie.
Yeah. Thank you, Charlie. Do you want to follow up?
Well, I just remember back in those days, Senator, that it was reported, not that I use TV 2020 type programs as my icon of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's my memory is that it was commonly reported that you were much more involved in that, and that you were involved in, I don't know how to use the word, but basically allowing Keating's scam to go on. And I just referenced that on a national basis, that was a big bill America had to pay. It seems like nobody remembers that, but whatever it was, say it was $150 billion, I think I'm relatively close, that's a lot of money. And when I hear you talking about reform and against special interests, it gives me pause. And I don't hear anybody asking you that question.
Well, Charlie, I'm glad you asked it.
Yeah. Well, thank you,
and,
thank you, Charlie.
I'm going to have the senator respond.
The question is asked regularly, Charlie. I'm happy to tell you. As I say, it's part of my record, and it was something that I did that was wrong. But there was a complete and thorough investigation of it, including public hearings, which lasted for several weeks of the Ethics Committee. I went on every talk show in America on this issue and described exactly what I did and what I didn't do. Everybody who observed it believed that the fact is that the judgment, that I was found guilty of bad judgment. And Charlie, now that you want to get into it, let me add one other aspect of this. Mr. Bob Bennett, who you know is the president's lawyer, one of the most respected lawyers in America, was asked by the Ethics Committee to conduct an independent counsel investigation. His conclusions and recommendations were that John Glenn and I be dropped from the further investigation because of our lack of involvement in it. For the first time in the history of the Ethics Committee, because I was the only Republican, the Ethics Committee did not release John Glenn and me from the investigation, and it went forward. And Charlie, I'd be glad to send you the statements that Mr. Bob Bennett made after he had completed a year-long independent investigation. I don't think he could be charged with bias in any direction, and maybe that would give some balance to your view as to the extent of my involvement in the Keating Five. But I will again state unequivocally, I did a wrong thing to do by appearing at a meeting with four other powerful senators with a group of regulators.
Let me ask you about another major issue that the next president will face, and that's Social Security reform.
Mm-hmm.
And one major reform that many people are looking at, especially in your party, is some type of privatization of the system. Do you support that idea?
Sure. I see no reason why people shouldn't be allowed to invest their tax dollars that are going to pay for their retirement in investments which are within reasonable parameters. The return on Treasury bills, which they're presently invested in, is 3%. Since 1945, the stock market, with all its ups and downs, has an average return annually of 5.5%. I think people ought to be allowed to invest their own money. The problem is, as you know, their own money is not going to an account with their name on it. Their own money is going to pay the benefits of present retirees. And that's why we have to have an infusion of money to make it solvent, and then it would be possible to allow them to make those investments. I have disagreed with the president quite frequently, but one of the least rational proposals that he's had is that the government invest people's retirement funds. That to me, is insane.
There could be some real conflict of interest there.
Sure, the business of government is not to be in business. And I think we'd all be majority stockholders in Ben and Jerry's by the time it was all through, because everything else would be politically incorrect. People should be allowed to invest their own savings so that they can take care of their retirement system. And obviously, there should be some advisory group that says, look, these are good investments, and you should have a wide menu to choose from. But unless we do that, the solvency aspect of it will be dramatically diminished.
So this $3 trillion surplus is not going to be enough to keep Social Security
I think it is if we invested in it. But remember, we're spending the surplus as we speak. In the name of emergency funding, we spent $7.5 billion on farm crisis. We spent $4.5 billion in a, quote, emergency on the census. In other words, Congress did not know that the year 2000 was arriving. So a lot of this surplus is being spent as we speak, and that, of course, is very deceptive to the American people and makes them very cynical, and understandably so.
Quickly, because I want to go back to the phones, mm-hmm. Should the surplus be spent also on tax cuts?
I think, yes, I think Americans deserve tax relief. But I think you've got to look at this in the context of all the major issues. Here they are: Social Security, Medicare, the debt, and tax relief. And we have to look at them in their entirety. Clearly, we have to reform Medicare. Clearly, we should pay down the debt because Americans owe that to future generations as well. But there are many areas that really we need tax relief. We need to eliminate the marriage penalty. There's no reason why we should have people pay additional taxes because they get married. We should raise the inheritance tax up to about $5 million. Why can't you pass on to your children what you've worked all your life to earn? We should eliminate the so-called earnings test. Why is it that a 65-year-old person pays as much as a third more in taxes on their wages if they choose to work after they're age 65? And we should lift the tax bracket of 15% up to around $70,000 a year so that lower-income Americans who are still paying around 40% of their income because of the addition of Medicare and Social Security taxes, they still need relief. And so we can do that, and it's not that expensive when you really look at it. But they've got to be taken in the context of the other aspects, compelling requirements we have as well.
You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, and our guest today is Arizona Senator John McCain. We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, in Concord, 224-8989. Our next caller is from Nashua. Seth's up. Hi, Seth.
Hey, how's it going, Laura?
Okay.
And Senator McCain, it's always hard to say this, but I respect you greatly because of your military service, and my hat's off to you as for your time that you spent in the Hilton.
Well, thank you, Seth.
Sorry about that. I have great respect. Anyway, I'm interested in knowing what your views are on the gun control issue, and I'm wondering what your strategy is going to be to refute the attempts by the anti-gun lobby to basically scare the citizenry and pass through bills that don't really do anything to solve crimes and just restrict our rights.
So, Seth, it sounds like I'm not sure how do you feel about gun control?
I think you're a Second Amendment guy, aren't you, Seth?
Indeed. I am. Go ahead. Sorry.
But thank you, Seth. Thank you for your kind comments. I am a Second Amendment person as well. I believe that we need to, and I think you would agree, do everything we can constitutionally to make guns unavailable to children. I believe that we passed a bill through the Senate, although not perfect, should be passed through the House. It has provision for safety locks. It has provision for closing the loopholes of pawn shops. It has background check provisions and other provisions that I think need to be passed. Your point, though, and I think you were alluding to it earlier on, is that we should enforce existing law. The terrible tragedy recently out in Los Angeles, that individual violated two federal laws and two state laws. The numbers of prosecution of existing laws have decreased under this present administration. I also would add one other point, and this is a very important issue. Republicans say that the problem is Hollywood, and Democrats say the problem is gun control. It is a multifaceted problem. A few weeks ago, General Colin Powell, General Schwarzkopf, I, Senator Lieberman, Democrat of Connecticut, Bill Bennett, and others signed a letter to Hollywood asking them to exercise some self-restraint on what they are producing and what are affecting young Americans' minds. If we took every gun and threw it in the Atlantic Ocean, I could still take you to a website where a child can learn how to make a pipe bomb. I can show you a video game where the object is to kill policemen. There is terrible kinds of things that are affecting young Americans. Senator Lieberman and I proposed an amendment, which was agreed to, that the Surgeon General study the effect of media violence on children and report to the Congress and the American people, which was done in 1972. So we've got to look at this issue in its entirety. We have to know what's affecting young Americans, and we have to try as a nation to work together. So I probably am not as exactly on your side, Seth, in that, but I do believe that we need to enforce existing laws. I believe the law, the bill we passed through the Senate, should be passed by the House, and I would be willing to look at other measures if necessary that make sense through the regular legislative hearing process and through national debate and discussion. Thanks, Seth.
Seth, I'm glad you raised the point. So the issue with background checks was one day at gun shows versus 3 days at gun shows, I believe. And what did you think?
I voted for 3 days because gun shows, I voted for one day because gun shows don't usually last for 3 days. So if you had to have, and I'm for instant background checks. I don't know why anybody would be opposed to an instant background check. If you have a 3 day waiting period and the gun show is over after 1 or 2 days, obviously that negates the ability to conduct a gun show.
Let's go next to Manchester. Marilyn's on her car phone. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Senator McCain. I wanted to ask you what you see as the federal role for the arts and humanities. In New Hampshire, we don't have any big cities, and we don't have a lot of huge corporate headquarters, and the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities have played a very important role, helping everyone from filmmaker Ken Burns to our struggling theaters. The Palace Theater in Manchester has gone bankrupt, basically. The theater in Portsmouth struggles. The American Stage Festival is threatening to go out of business. The National Endowment for the Arts has been very reduced in size. It's been important to our state. How what do you see as a federal role in that area? Would you support the continued budget for the National Endowment for the Arts or an increase in that budget?
I would probably support at least some of it. I do not support it when egregious things happen, such as Mr. Mapplethorpe's paintings and works, a crucifix in a...
Well, you know, he had a Catholic education, and he was making a statement about the commercialization of capital.
I don't care if he was for motherhood and apple pie. I am offended when my tax dollars go for such a terrible thing.
Issue's kind of in the past.
Hey, Marilyn.
The whole endowment, so they don't give grants for contemporary artists anymore?
You know, Marilyn,
do you support the budget in the future?
Yeah, let's get to that point, because we're running
not true,
to the end.
Marilyn, that these things have been eliminated. There's a woman that covers herself with chocolate that we pay for.
They no longer give grants to contemporary
Let's get
artists.
To the, you Marilyn, know what?
Again,
Let's
I
get to the
repeat,
major point.
No, I won't get to the major point because Americans are offended when their tax dollars are used for such a thing. That is the point. So,
will you eliminate the arts endowment?
Marilyn, I will not eliminate the arts endowment, but I will oppose increases in any funding until such time as these egregious examples and that are offensive to all Americans that I know are eliminated, and I know they are not eliminated. Every time we turn around, they say they're eliminated, and then there is some new grant and some new egregious aspect of this misuse of Americans' tax dollars.
I think you're misinformed.
I think you are misinformed, and I would be glad to do more research, and I'd be glad to send you the information. And how you can excuse such a thing as what Mr. Mapplethorpe did as because of a product of a Catholic education staggers my imagination. I thank you, Marilyn, for the call.
Marilyn, thanks for bringing it up. I think your point seems to be once you are 100% assured that incidents like this will not happen, then NEA funding is fine.
I also think that it's very important we have state and local funding to match it. If the economy of the state of New Hampshire is in the best shape it's been in this century. And I think that we should have state and local funding match to show their commitment as well to it. And I don't believe, very frankly, that some of this money has been evenly distributed throughout the country as well. I'd like to look at that formula at the same time. But in all due respect, for someone to say to me that it's because someone did this because of a Catholic education, I mean, I'm sorry, but I can't, that dialogue cannot take place. I was offended by it, and I think all Americans were offended by it. And I know that if Marilyn were still on the line, her other response would be, well, it was only a small amount of money. It doesn't matter if it was 5 cents. The American taxpayers' dollars should not be used for these kinds of egregious things. And it's not just that. It's a number of things that have taken place over the years. Every time they come back and say, well, these have been eliminated, and then there's another case. And Marilyn, if you'll drop me a note, I will give you a numerous other examples of this outrageous use of my tax dollars. So, but I do think we have a role in government to encourage development of the arts and other programs.
Senator McCain, we have just about a minute left, maybe less, but I did want to ask you about a candidate's personal life. This has been an issue, especially in the case of George W. Bush and some people saying he might have used drugs when he was younger. What do we, the voters, need to know, and what is none of our business?
In the specific case of the governor, I believe he has a right to privacy on that issue. But it's the media and the American public who will set the bar as to what is private and what isn't private. The kind of candidate has the right to not answer, but the American people will then decide which is appropriate and which isn't. We've come a long way in recent years, as we know, in the privacy aspects. It's part of the business of running for public office. It's tough. I worry a little bit about the demotivating aspects of it to young people to seek public office, but in this business, you're going to be asked questions, and it's up to you to answer. But those questions, I think, are determined by the media and the American people.
Okay. And we will wrap it up with that. Thank you very much.
And I'm glad to end it with a spirited exchange on the national.